Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Dale Greenwald. He's research associate in the laboratory of Dr. Conrad Labandera, curator of fossil arthropods in the paleobiology department at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. And today we're focusing on his book, Remnants of Ancient Life: The New Science of Old Fossils. So, Dr. Greenwald, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Ricardo. Thank you for inviting me.
So, before we get into the biomolecules you go through in the book that can be preserved in or as fossils, I guess we're going to get into that. Just to introduce the topic, I mean, when you find a fossil, first of all, what are the most common kinds of fossils that we expect to find? And when we do find them, what kinds of information can we usually expect to gather from them?
So the classical definition of a fossil, of course, is either an impression or a compression of a organism that died millions of years ago. And from that fossil, we can gain a lot of information about the organism's structure. And if we can study similar fossils, we can compare them and we can construct a phylogeny based simply on structure, which can give us a lot of information about the evolution of those organisms. But it's all based on what we can see visually, the structure of the fossil itself. And that for hundreds of years has defined what the science of paleobiology is. It's changing now, however, with the advent of ancient biomolecules.
And I mean, how are biomolecules preserved in fossils? Because I would imagine that there are limits to this, correct?
Absolutely, yes, there are limits. For example, DNA. Originally, it was thought that it would be impossible for it to be preserved, simply because it's a very sensitive molecule and it's easily degraded. But now we have ancient DNA that's about 2 million years old. Proteins, similarly, are easily degraded. But in fact, just this year, a new paper came out, and now we have a protein that is, I think, 11 or 12 subunits long that is 6.3 million years old. This is relatively young, of course, compared to fossils that are hundreds of millions of years old. And the methods by which ancient biomolecules are preserved is as varied as the fossils themselves. There isn't one particular mechanism for preservation. There are many, and we are simply lucky that a number of them work and provide us with these amazing fossil records.
But I mean, when it comes to the oldest biomolecules we've found preserved, we're talking about at best units of millions of years, right? That's what we're talking
Yes,
about here.
for DNA and protein, it's relatively young, but there are other biomolecules. For example, a broad category of chemicals called porphyrins, one of which is heme, the molecule in hemoglobin that binds and releases oxygen. That is a very important biomolecule, and it is potentially, hundreds of millions of years old. And in fact, the people who are exploring Mars right now have instruments on the surface of Mars. And one of the things they will do is to try to identify the molecule, the porphyrin molecule. And so some biomolecules can, in theory, perhaps be as much as a billion years old.
Mm-hmm. And to what extent would it be possible for us to get a better understanding of the origins of life on Earth by studying some of these preserved biomolecules?
That's a difficult project, because life originated billions of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
There is one very interesting aspect of ancient biomolecules, which involves something called ancient sequence reconstruction,
mm-hmm.
where we use computers, artificial intelligence, if you will, to try to predict what the sequence of DNA and proteins were hundreds of millions, perhaps even billions of years ago. And one study actually came up with evidence that supported the origin of life at mid-oceanic ridges, where we have these structures called black smokers, where very hot water is being released from the inner portions of the Earth. And because of the warm temperatures there, and because of all the nutrients that accumulate around those sites, there's always been a theory that that, in fact, is where life originated. It did not originate on land, but mm-hmm. rather at the mid-oceanic ridges. And laboratories have used this technique of ancient ancestral reconstruction to show that proteins that may have existed at those sites functioned at very high temperatures, unlike the proteins we have today.
And so one of the illustrative examples you explore in your book about how biomolecules get preserved and some of the fossils associated with them, and then, of course, the information you can gather by studying these biomolecules, is the fossil of a blood-engorged mosquito. So could you tell us a little bit about the story behind that fossil?
We're all familiar with blood-engorged mosquitoes, right? Mm-hmm. We have watched them as they fill full of blood on our arm or our hand. They're very, very delicate. And one would never expect that such an organism would be preserved. But conditions under which the fossil insects were preserved at this site in northwestern Montana were very, very unique, in that the fossil insects were blown over or flew over the surface of a lake, but they didn't simply fall into the water and mm-hmm. sink to the bottom of the lake. What we think happened in many cases, perhaps not all, but in many cases, the surface of the water at that period of time was covered with a layer of cyanobacteria, an algal mat. Some people call it green slime. And this material is very sticky. And so when a tiny insect would fall onto it, the insect would be trapped.
Mm-hmm.
And the algae or the cyanobacteria is photosynthetic. And so it grows towards the sun. And as it continues to grow, it would surround and envelop the tiny insect. And it would protect it from many of the things that might otherwise destroy the insect. And once the temperatures cooled a little bit, that layer of algae would sink to the bottom of the lake with the entombed insect.
Mm-hmm.
and would continue to protect it. It was very unique preservational conditions. And so it, in fact, was able to preserve these blood and gorge mosquitoes. And it, in fact, is the only place in the world where we have fossils of blood and gorge mosquitoes. When I first saw this fossil, the first thing that came to mind was this enlarged and very dark abdomen. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, wow, might that be blood? And of course, thinking that it might be blood is very different than proving that it is blood.
Right.
And we were very lucky in being able to use modern technology to, in fact, prove that that fossil mosquito, which was 46 million years old, contained remnants of hemoglobin.
And so for the audience to get, let's say, a better understanding of how you go about studying these biomolecules, could you tell us a little bit more about the sort of techniques that you and your colleagues used in the particular case of the mosquito fossil, but we can also talk a little bit about that when it comes to other kinds of biomolecules, and particularly when you studied the heme molecule in this case?
Yes, the technology is very important. One of the things that paleobiologists dislike are techniques that require the destruction of the fossil in order to analyze it.
Right.
And so we had two techniques available to us. The first was called energy dispersive spectroscopy, or EDS. And we use that to demonstrate that there are very high levels of the metal iron in the abdomen of the mosquito. It was absent from other parts of the mosquito or the surrounding rock. And the heme molecule contains iron at its center. And in fact, it's the iron molecule that attaches to and releases oxygen. Mm-hmm. And so it's an integral part of the heme molecule. So knowing that there were large amounts of iron there, we suspected that the heme molecule might also be there. And so we used a technique called secondary ion mass spectrometry, which is non-destructive. It doesn't harm the fossil, but it breaks tiny molecules into fragments and creates fingerprint patterns of fragments that we can use to definitively identify the presence of small molecules. So those two techniques, both of them non-destructive, showed us that, in fact, the porphyrin molecule heme was still there.
And so another kind of molecules that you talk about in the book are related to ancient pigments. So could you tell us how ancient pigments are studied? And by studying them, what can we learn about a particular species?
I think pigments probably are the most common of all ancient biomolecules that extend really into deep time, hundreds of millions of years old.
Yeah.
You have to be a serious organic chemist in order to study them, because you use very high-tech instrumentation like infrared spectroscopy and other techniques. But if you have a specimen that is large enough, and it is a destructive technology because you have to scrape off a bit of the molecule in order to isolate the pigment, Using these techniques, you can determine the exact structure, the organic structure of these pigments. Some pigments, however, frustratingly, are difficult to analyze. For example, probably the most common pigment that we think about, especially when we think about what color the feathers of T-Rex were, is melanin. And of course, melanin is responsible for all kinds of different pigmentation in many different animals. But melanin, despite the fact that it's very common, is very difficult to identify. It comes in a variety of structures, and those structures are really exceedingly large. And in fact, a number of papers have been published where scientists attempt to identify melanin, but in fact, using, for example, mass spectrometry, they can only say that their data is suggestive of the presence. So what scientists have turned to is a proxy. They are unable to identify the pigment itself, and so they have used the shape and size of the tiny granules that store melanin as a proxy. If a if one of these storage granules is long and thin, as opposed to oval, they assign colors to it. And it's a bit controversial. We're still not sure if that is entirely accurate. A lot of pictures have been published of beautiful dinosaurs with green and orange and red feathers. But right now, those are colors that we think might have occurred. We don't have any definitive proof yet.
And we are also not sure about the degree of certainty we have when it comes to the color of their feathers and skin, right? I mean, in the particular case of dinosaurs, people generally seem to be very fascinated by them, and we see all of those depictions of dinosaurs with those bright colors, but we are not sure that they really had those sorts of colors that we see, right?
That is absolutely correct. It is a very dinocentric world that we live in. Everyone wants to know what the dinosaurs look like, and perhaps at some point in the future we will.
But when it comes to studying ancient pigments and perhaps gathering more information about particular species that already went extinct, is it possible for us to perhaps learn a little bit more about what would have been their behavior through color patterns, for example?
Thank you, Ricardo, for asking that question, because the whole reason we study ancient molecules is to try to learn not just about their evolution, that is, evolution of the organisms and their phylogeny, but things like behavior and physiology. It's very difficult to study these phenomena from simple rock structures. So, for example, crinoids that lived in the ocean hundreds of millions of years ago, like today's relatives of crinoids, are often brightly colored, bright red. And we have been able to show that these crinoids were in fact pigmented hundreds of millions of years ago. And they probably served the same function that they serve today. And that is that many crinoids contain a poisonous molecule, and which in some cases is the pigment itself, but the pigment also serves as a warning sign and tells potential predators to stay away. You know, don't eat me, I'm poisonous. And it is that type of behavior that we could never be able to learn about if we were simply looking at the structure of the organism. And a wonderful example of learning about the physiology of an organism through study of its pigments, although in this case, the pigment is not something that is displayed on in the skin of the organism. Mm-hmm. The porphyrins, the heme molecule, are also color. They are pigments. The green color of leaves is due to chlorophyll. And the porphyrin molecule inside of chlorophyll, and it's a pigment. It's green. So blood is red. It's a pigment. And scientists were able to actually isolate purified, actually they were able to synthesize pure hemoglobin from mammoths, 40,000-year-old mammoths, and they were able to show that the hemoglobin in the mammoths 40,000 years ago functioned very differently from the way it functions today. It is more able to release its oxygen at cold temperatures, and by so doing, it keeps the peripheral structures of the mammoth warm, which it had to do back 40,000 years ago when everything was in the middle of the ice ages. Whereas today's, for example, the Asian or African elephant, the hemoglobin doesn't like cold temperatures and refuses to release its oxygen at cold temperatures. So we have been able to identify the biochemical basis for some physiology of some, albeit shallow time, fossils, the mammoths.
And still on the topic of pigmentation, in what ways can it be related to a mechanism like sexual selection?
I'm glad you asked that question because, in fact, I'm in the process of doing some interesting research on some. This is not in the book, Ricardo. This is new work.
Okay.
On something called female sexual display. And I think we all know it in the natural world, it's almost always the males that have sexual displays. You know, the bright colors and the strutting around, you know, that kind of thing. And so the existence of female sexual display is very interesting to behaviorists, scientists who study behavior.
Right.
And in this particular case, we have a type of fly where the females have enlarged and very darkly pigmented wings, which attracts the males, which is very important because the females do not feed. The only nutrition they get is when the male brings them some prey to feed on. And while the female feeds on that prey, the male mates with the female fly. Mm-hmm. And so here's a case where we have, in this work that I'm doing now, the first example of, in the fossil record, of female sexual display, and it's based totally on the presence of pigments in the wings of those female flies. So here we can trace perhaps the evolution of that behavior, as well as the presence of that display behavior in the fossil record. Does that come close to answering your question?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does. And I have just one more question about pigments before we move on to other biomolecules that you also explore in the book. So can we study the evolution of color vision through pigmentation?
That's an interesting question. And given that color vision is thought to have evolved hundreds of millions of years ago, mm-hmm. it is it's difficult. What we can do is simply make the assumption that if there were colors hundreds of millions of years ago, there must have been color vision.
Right.
One way that we can try to estimate the age of color vision is by use, excuse me, of something called the molecular clock, which was invented by a very famous chemist, Pauling, 60 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that is, we can study the sequence of different species of organisms, and we can use that protein sequence to predict how those proteins changed back in time. And we can go hundreds of millions of years back in time, and we can make predictions of when the molecules that are responsible for color visions, they're called opsins, we can make predictions about when they first occurred. So on that level, the answer to your question is yes, we can make predictions about the evolution of color vision. But in terms of using the actual fossil pigments, we have not made it there yet.
And so now I would like to move on to biometals. And I have two big questions about that kind of biomolecule. So first of all, what is the importance of biometals for life itself? What kind of roles do they play?
I think it's important that we all understand that metals, those that are present in life forms, that is the biometals, are essential for life. Without them, there would be no life. And metals can occur in elemental form, that is a big nodule of pure iron or pure copper, but usually they occur as metal salts. So, for example, bone has calcium, which of course is a metal, but it's not elemental metal. It is a metal salt, calcium carbonate, calcium apatite. And in fact, most metals in living organisms are salts of those metals. In some cases, we're not sure exactly what the structure of the metals were in some organisms. For example, in the book, we talk about the discovery of ancient metals that strengthen and reinforce the jaws of insects. And even the insects that live today, which still reinforce their jaws with metals, we still don't know what the structure of those metals is in those organisms. There's much yet to be learned. And because metals can be detected fairly easily and at very low levels and in non-destructive ways, biometals is becoming a very important part of ancient biomolecule research. And I think we're going to see more and more papers about it.
And so, of course, again, I have to repeat this kind of question for biometals, because I think it's one of the most interesting parts of what you explore in the book when it comes to the different biomolecules, but what kinds of information can we get from them? So, for example, when we talked about pigmentation, we've mentioned phylogenetic information, behavioral information as well. In this case of biometals, I would imagine that physiological information is a very evident sort of thing that we can get from them. So, but generally speaking, what can we learn by studying ancient biometals?
I would have to preface any answer with the observation that we really need to know more about biometals in living organisms.
Okay.
Before we can go on to ask intelligent questions about ancient organisms. The science is very new, and very little work has been done actually on ancient biometals, other than, for example, heme and other porphyrin metals. Laboratories are investigating the structure of biometals in living organisms, and they're discovering that Mother Nature is much more complicated than we ever thought it was, and produces structures that we have, as scientists have never even dreamed about. So there's a lot to learn about biometals, and I think we have to do more work on living organisms before we can answer your question, Ricardo.
Okay, so I mean, when it comes to the several different possible things we could learn from biometals, like, for example, phylogenetic information, anatomical information, physiological information, behavioral, and so on, it's still very limited at this point, at least.
Yes, I'm not sure to what degree we can learn very much about phylogeny, but we can definitely learn a lot about the physiology of organisms based on the study of biometals.
And so let's talk a little bit about proteins here. So what kinds of proteins get preserved in fossils?
That's a great question. The paper that just came out by a scientist from the University of Turin in Italy, Di Marchi was the senior author of this paper, extends the age of ancient biomolecules to over 6 million years. And the sequence they found had a very unique sequence of four negatively charged subunits. And that protein was isolated from the shell of a bird. Almost all proteins that are isolated either from bones, from teeth, from eggshells, or from the shells of snails and gastropods. And all of those environments have calcium carbonate or calcium apatite, which is positively charged or has positive charges. And so proteins that are negative that can bind to the positive charges in the bone, the teeth, the shells, are those that are most likely to be preserved. And now that's for deep time fossils. For shallow time, and let's define shallow time as something around maybe several million years old, we can get more proteins and different types of proteins simply because they are young and haven't degraded yet. And so our studies, for example, of the ancestors of human, which rely on fossil skeletons, we can get entire proteomes. And by the definition of a proteome, of course, is the sequences of every protein in an organism. And so what we can learn from those is almost limitless. And so the answer to your question, Ricardo, it very much depends on how old the specimen is. I think one of the directions where ancient biomolecule research will expand is in the area of marine mollusk shells. Shells of gastropods and clams go back hundreds of millions of years. Most of them have been replaced, the shell material has been replaced with other type of rock, but in many cases, they're still the same chemicals that made up the original shell of the living organism, and those shells contain proteins. And we just have to be able to work with them more. And I think what we'll find we're going to find thousands of new sequences from that source.
And okay, so let me ask you perhaps a few more questions about proteins, because I think that there are many interesting things here that we could explore. To what extent can we learn more about the physiology of particular organisms by studying these preserved proteins? And I know that this is a very broad question, because proteins are everywhere. I mean, they play all sorts of different roles, and there's I don't know how many proteins out there in biological, in organisms. I mean, they're everywhere, basically. But can we learn more about their physiology by studying these proteins? And perhaps, I don't know if you want to illustrate that with perhaps a few examples or not.
Sure. The answer to your request, Ricardo, is a yes with an exclamation point. And given that most ancient proteins are isolated from shallow time fossils, those that are tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years old, and we can get their entire proteome, the sequence of every protein in the organism, we can learn everything about their physiology. we can determine, for example, that some ancient humans or Neanderthals were had an allergy to milk. That's one tiny example. Their immune system was different, and in fact, all of us contain a little bit of DNA and proteins that we inherited from our Neanderthal ancestors, right? And some of those proteins affect our immune system. Mm-hmm. And some of us are, in fact, more susceptible to catching the COVID virus. Mm-hmm. Because of the presence of Neanderthal proteins in our bodies. So because we can isolate the entire proteome of many organisms, the answer to your question is that it's a gold mine of work that we can do relative to how the physiology of ancient humans and ancient organisms differed from modern day humans and other animals. You know, our studies of human evolution, Homo sapiens migration from Africa, our studies of the genetics of the Neanderthals, we've learned so much about that, and yet we've just scratched the surface. The future is going to be very, very exciting relative to our understanding of human evolution because of what we can learn about or from proteins about our behavior and physiology.
And can we learn more about phylogenetics from ancient proteins? And I mean, while I'm asking you this, I'm probably asking you two different types of questions. I mean, if we can learn about phylogenetics directly from ancient proteins or also indirectly learning more about genetics from proteins.
The older the specimen is, the older the protein is, the more we can learn. It's all dependent on how far back we can isolate proteins and DNA from. The construction of phylogenies and phylogenetics is something that is dependent on having a lot of specimens from a lot of different periods of time.
Right.
And the further back in time, the more phylogenetics we can do. And right now, we're kind of limited by the fact that ancient DNA and ancient proteins don't go very far back in time. And this might be an appropriate time to bring up the work of Dr. Mary Schweitzer, who has published about the sequences from dinosaurs that are hundreds of millions of years old or 100 million years old. This work is very controversial. Her work can't be reproduced by some of the laboratories.
Yeah.
And so I think the consensus is that the oldest DNA is only about 2 million years old. The oldest proteins are about 4 million years old, now 6 million years old with the work from Italy. I think we all hope that Dr. Schweitzer is correct and that, in fact, we can isolate proteins from dinosaurs because it would be wonderful to be able to do phylogenetics, reconstruct the phylogeny of dinosaurs and compare that work to the phylogenies we have made that are based simply on structure.
And so just before we get directly into ancient DNA, since you mentioned dinosaurs there briefly again, so one interesting thing that I read about in your book is when we find dinosaur bones, sometimes it's not just the bones themselves that we can study, but also ancient blood vessels within them, right? So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, that is the work of Dr. Schweitzer. Mm-hmm. And she's very famous for showing all of us that you can take a dinosaur bone, and when you dissolve all the minerals, you are left over with this soft tissue. It almost looks like a tiny little piece of meat. And within that material, you can isolate structures that very much look like blood vessels.
Okay.
And this work has been repeated by many, many different laboratories. I have been able to repeat this work myself in the lab. And the problem is, what is that material made of? And if, in fact, it is made of protein and DNA, can we isolate it intact? And that is the big controversy. Some people say no, some people say yes.
So talking then about ancient DNA, how well does it get preserved and in what kinds of structures?
Again, almost all ancient DNA comes from bones or teeth.
Mm-hmm.
There is something called environmental DNA,
okay,
where people just take a shovel full of dirt from the bottom of a cave and they can isolate DNA, which is very surprising given how fragile a molecule it is. But most ancient DNA is isolated from bones and teeth. And in some cases, if the specimen is young enough, we can get the entire genome, the genome being all of the DNA from a particular organism. And again, if we have that kind of information, we can determine a great deal of things about the behavior, physiology, phylogeny of that organism. It all depends on its age. Oldest DNA, I think, is about 2 million years old, and it's only fragmentary, and it's fairly difficult to do any in-depth work on phylogenetics with something that is that fragmentary. I'm not sure I answered your question, Ricardo. Please restate the question if I didn't.
Yes, one part of the question that perhaps you didn't answer directly, I think, is how well it gets preserved. I mean, is it easy for it to get preserved, ancient DNA, or not?
Yeah, so again, it's dependent on the age of the specimen. Mm-hmm. And the younger the age, it can be preserved entirely intact, beautifully preserved. And the older we go, the less there is, and the more fragmentary it is. So everything depends on age. I think ancient DNA, depending on how we define ancient, has drastically changed the sciences of anthropology and archaeology, because those two sciences work in the realm of shallow time. Specimens that are 1,000 years old, or 5,000, 10,000, 100,000 years old. And DNA is beautifully preserved under many conditions in specimens that are just tens of thousands of years old. It's a near infinite amount of information that we can obtain from those specimens. But again, that's not in the field of paleobiology. That's more anthropology and archaeology. A good example is our understanding of the evolution of the Black Death, or the bubonic plague.
Mm-hmm.
Which right. First appeared in the early 1300s. And we were able to isolate DNA from the skeletons of people who died from the Black Death.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to study the evolution of that virus, and even determine when, in fact, it underwent a mutation to become terribly pathogenic. So yeah, the future of shallow time DNA is, it's going to be very exciting to see what happens here in the future.
So if I understand it correctly, the amount of information that we can potentially get from ancient DNA is so much and so varied, that's probably one of the reasons why many people usually refer to ancient DNA as the holy grail of ancient biomolecules, right?
Yeah, yeah. DNA, of course, encodes proteins. And so much of the genetic information from DNA is present in proteins, but there is a lot of genetic information that is in DNA only. Mm-hmm. And it is, easier to do phylogenetic reconstruction using DNA than it is protein. So there are distinct advantages to using DNA. We just have to figure out how to extract it more effectively and more efficiently from older specimens.
And at this point in time, do we have any idea at all about when DNA might have first originated on Earth, at least?
No. It's a short question, or a short answer to a very complicated question. People think it may... Well, in fact, we have fossils of single-celled organisms that are over a billion years old, okay. A billion with a B. Mm-hmm. And so we know there was life on Earth that is a billion, perhaps 2 billion years old. And we have to assume that because life was able to reproduce even back then, that there is a DNA-based mechanism for reproduction. So we have to assume that DNA evolved at least 2 billion years ago, probably longer. Mm-hmm. But we don't know how, and we don't know exactly when. There are some scientists who believe that it was not DNA that was the basis of original life forms, but in fact, RNA.
Right.
But again, there's no way to prove that. RNA is, in fact, even more fragile than DNA. Mm-hmm. And it's very unlikely that we will ever be able to recover ancient RNA.
So at least at this point in time, it's not possible to get RNA from fossils?
Correct.
Oh, okay. And before we get into other topics, let me just ask you one more question. How much can we learn about the ancestry of our own species through ancient DNA? Because, you know, there's always this sort of very interesting questions, or questions that people are usually very interested about, particularly paleoanthropologists and people like that, about, for example, our last common ancestor with chimpanzees and bonobos, and our exact hominin lineage and all of that. So can ancient DNA help us answer those kinds of questions?
Yeah, I'm looking for a book up on my bookshelf here. Robert Reich wrote a book about that. And in fact, many books have been written about the phylogeny, the evolution of not just Homo sapiens, but our ancestors, mm-hmm. and not just our most recent ancestors, the Neanderthal, but Homo erectus, and way back to over a million years old. The amount of information that we can obtain from our studies of ancient DNA from the genus Homo is mind-boggling. there is so much we can learn. And again, it's not just phylogenetics, it's behavioral, it's physiological. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, there are many books written about this already, and there will be many more. We've barely scratched the surface. There are so many different questions. It is an area that I did not cover to any great extent in the book because I am not an expert on DNA. And so I'm proud of the fact that I know what I don't know. And so I leave it to other experts to tell you about the work with ancient DNA. But it will revolutionize science, and it will revolutionize our understanding of the evolution of our own species.
So, I mean, throughout the entire interview, we've been focusing a lot on animals. But what about plants? What have we learned about, for example, early plant life and the evolution of plants through ancient biomolecules?
Unfortunately, the answer is almost nothing. And the reason that we have learned so little from plants, and I'm not trying to be facetious or comical here, is that plants don't have bones. And that's where we get all of our ancient DNA and all of our ancient protein. Plants are made of soft tissue, which is very easily degraded. Mm-hmm. There is almost nothing in the scientific literature on plant DNA because it just degrades so very, very quickly. There is a little bit about plant protein, but it's only a few thousand years old. The most we know about ancient biomolecules from plants is based on what we call small molecules. And even that doesn't go very far back in time. Let me define small molecules by giving some examples. We have all made extracts of plants, usually using hot water, that contain small molecules like caffeine, for example, from the coffee bean and from tea leaves. There are literally tens of thousands of small molecules that are unique to plants. Think of all the hallucinogenic drugs, for example, aspirin. Acetyl salicylic acid is a small molecule that you can isolate from plants. All of these are unique to plants. They're not present in animals, and they can be preserved in plants that go back many millions of years. And in fact, at one point in time, some scientists proposed that we study phylogenetics based on the presence of those small molecules. So I guess the term phylogenetics wouldn't be the appropriate term, but it would be a way to study the evolution of plants based on their small molecules. And so you would take a fossil leaf, and you would scrape it off of a rock, and you would extract it just like you would extract a tea leaf. And from that extract, you would be able to isolate tiny molecules, some of which may be unique to that particular plant. And so you could differentiate one plant from another. You could actually do taxonomy based on the presence of small molecules that are unique to individual plants. that chemotaxonomy, let's call it that, let's give it that name, chemotaxonomy, never caught on. It is not really used at all in modern plant taxonomy, but it does exist simply because of the presence of these small molecules in plants for literally tens of millions of years.
So I have two final general questions, let's say, to ask you. So potentially, how much of the phylogenies and ancient physiologies of the total biomass of the Earth can we, or could we, get a good understanding of through ancient genomes, proteomes, and of course, other biomolecules?
We don't know. I think it's most of us should appreciate that 90% of all the species of organisms that have ever lived on Earth are now extinct. Mm-hmm. And so that means that 90% of everything we have to learn from is in the fossil record.
Right.
And so potentially there's a huge amount we can learn. We're limited only by the preservation or the lack of preservation of the chemicals, whether they're DNA or protein, pigments or small molecules. I think paleobiology will change over the next few years, and they will take ancient biomolecules research to heart, and more young people, I think, are becoming very interested in ancient biomolecule research. And I think it is a new and rapidly growing field. There's a huge amount of potential, but I certainly can't put a number on it right now, Ricardo. I wish I could, but again, we're despite the fact that we might publish a lot and think we know a lot, we're pretty ignorant about the evolution of life on Earth.
That's fair enough. And that also makes for a good segue to my last question. And you've already talked a little bit about this, but how do you look at the future of the study of ancient biomolecules and the information we can potentially get from them? I mean, are there any predictions you would make? Are there, for example, any exciting new developments that you're seeing?
I think the most exciting development in the field of ancient biomolecule research has nothing to do with fossils. And that's because it is a science called ancient sequence reconstruction, where we use computers to predict the sequence of ancient proteins or ancient DNA. Mm-hmm. And this, interestingly and perhaps surprisingly, is most commonly used in drug discovery. By pharmaceutical companies, because they want to understand the evolution of disease. They want to understand the evolution of proteins that cause various diseases. Mm-hmm. And we can try to predict using this computer-based science of ancient sequence construction. We can try to determine how proteins that cause disease differed back in time and what happened to them to make them cause disease. And this will give us a basis for developing drugs that will help us to treat those diseases. So in a way, here we're talking about drug discovery, and we're supposed to be talking about ancient proteins. But I think, believe it or not, the two are related.
That's amazing. And so let's perhaps end on that note then. And the book is again, Remnants of Ancient Life, The New Science of Old Fossils. I'm leaving a link to it in the description of the interview. And Dr. Greenwald, just before we go, apart from your book, would you like to tell people where they can find your work on the internet?
Yes, the book is published by Princeton University Press, and it can be purchased at their website. Mm-hmm. And one thing I would like to say is that all of my profits, such as they are, go directly to the library of the Natural History Museum in at the Smithsonian. Mm-hmm. And so if anyone, in fact, does purchase a book, they will be able to, in doing so, contribute to the libraries. I wish that I could sign everyone's book based through the Zoom session, but I guess that's not technically possible yet. But I hope that people would find that it is an enjoyable read.
No, let me just say myself that I found it a really fascinating read. I really loved the book, and I hope that everyone in my audience runs and buys it. It's very interesting. So thank you so much for writing the book and also, of course, for coming on the show. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Ricardo. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Hi guys, thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you liked it, please share it, leave a like and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlights, learning and development done differently. Check their website at enlights.com, and also please consider supporting the show on Patreon or PayPal. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Perga Larsen, Jerry Mullerens, Frederick Sundo, Bernardo Seixas, Olaf Alex, Adam Castle, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollacy, Eric Alenia, John Connors, Philip Force Connolly, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegar, Rui Inácio, Zup, Mark Neves, Colin Holbrook, Phil Kavanagh, Michael Stormir, Samuel Andrea, Francis Forte, Iago Nunes, Fergal Cussen, Hal Herzog, Nuno Machado, Jonathan Labyrinth, João Linhares, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, João Eira, Tom Hummel, Sardes France, David Sloan Wilson, Yacila Dez Araújo, Romain Roach, Diego Londonho Correa, Yannick Puntara, Dana Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavlo Stasevski, Nelek Bakka, Madison, Gary G. Alman, Sam Afzal, Adrian Yegi, Paul Tolentino, João Barbosa, Julian Price, Edward Hall, Edin Bronner, Douglas Fry, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortez, Ursula Litsky, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy, Sunny Smith, John Wiseman, Daniel Friedman, William Buckner, Paul George Arnaud, Luke Loaki, Georgios Theophanes, Chris Williamson, Peter Wolosin, David Williams, Diogo Costa, Anton Erickson, Charles Murray, Alex Shaw, Maury Martinez, Coralie Chevalier, Bangalore Atheists, Larry Dealey Jr., Old Herringbone, Sterry, Michael Bailey, Dan Sperber, Robert Gracie, Igor N., Jeff McMahon, Jake Zuhl, Barnabas Radix, Mark Campbell, Thomas Dovner, Luke Nissen, Chris Story, Kimberly Johnson, Benjamin Galbert, Jessica Nowicki, Linda Brandon, Nicholas Carlson, Ismael Benzliman, George Koryatis, Valentin Steinman, Per Crawley, Kate Van Goller, Alexander Hubbard, Liam Dunaway, B.R., Masood Ali Mohammadi, Perpendicular, Jonas Hertner, Ursula Goodenough, Gregory Hastings, David Pinsoff, Sean Nelson, Mike Levine, and Jos Necht. A special thanks to my producers, Isar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Tafiniak, Tom Vanagden, Bernard Ugni, Curtis Dixon, Benedict Mueller, Thomas Trumbull, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Giancarlo Montenegro, Alni Cortiz, and Nick Golden, and to my executive producers, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Quadriano, Bogdan Canivets, and Rosie. Thank you for all.